One of the best ways I've learned from others is to create the perfect environment to share. I stumbled into support groups, really, but from the first one I attended, I felt a closeness to the others in the room that I couldn't describe. Since then, I've put my finger on it. The closeness came from vulnerability and opening up about challenges, dreams, goals, successes, and failures. Trusting others to listen to you without judgment and then returning the favor. It works. Don't let the term support group scare you away. There doesn't have to be anything wrong with you to want to connect with others. It's normal. Did you hear me? No matter what is socially acceptable today, connecting and sharing with others, even strangers, is normal. Find a group or create one of your own. Typically, I bring a topic or idea to the groups I lead to get us started. Then attendees can share about that or whatever's on their hearts. I'm there to keep us encouraged and on track, but the real magic comes from the interactions outside of me. If you want to learn more, reach out to me and I'll give you information on starting your own group in your area. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, see people, slow down and take notice, intentionally reach out and connect with someone to share and learn. Every stage of life is captured in the people around you. Don't let them go unnoticed. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you. How I wound up here. All I needed.
KBOO Portland.
It's Giving Tuesday, the international holiday where we all give back. Unleash your radical generosity and donate to KBOO Community Radio right now at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. This Giving Tuesday, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar up to $5,000 thanks to the generous support of KBOO member Jeff Sackett. Double the impact of your gift today. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.
Hello, and welcome to Coast Range Radio, a production of the Coast Range Association. I'm Michael Gaskill, Communications Director for the Coast Range Association, and your host for Coast Range Radio. My guest today is Joe Siemens. Joe is a musician and educator based in the Pacific Northwest and dedicated to helping people connect with their heritage through music and storytelling. As director of the Rhapsody Project, he works with youth in Seattle to explore the influence of regional and personal history through the lens of American blues and folk songs. He also serves as board chair of the Maxville Heritage Interpretive Center. Joe was born and raised in northwestern Oregon, and he's made a living interpreting the songs and stories of local sawmills, logging, and fishing ballads composed by elder working folks and folklorists of the region. Many of these songs are included on the 2016 album Timberbound by the band of the same name. In the same vein, Joe directed and served as executive producer for a Smithsonian Folkways album entitled Roll Columbia, Woody Guthrie's 26 Northwest Songs. All of the music you'll hear on the show today is from one of Joe's musical projects. So if you like what you hear, head over to joebanjo.net. Joe Siemens, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Delighted to be here, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we are happy to have you. I think you are our first musician guest. And right up at the top, we've known each other a little bit for a little while. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. I think since the first time I heard you play in, which would have been, I think, with Renegade String Band.
And I'm, for sure.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember when the first time you and I crossed paths was.
I feel like we must have just been picking at a party somewhere.
Yeah.
Some of the Southeast Portland, you know, hangs.
Yeah.
That's my best guess.
I think so. And like connecting with you and the rest of the Renegade folks, I really have a good memory of that, like at one of the Northwest Folklife Festivals from like 10 years ago or something. Were you a part of organizing that at all?
Of the Folklife Festival?
Yeah.
No, but my buddy Ben, who's also my business partner in several endeavors, he is now the artistic director of Northwest Folklife as of last year.
Okay.
So there is that connection.
Right. I do remember reading that. And I've always just loved the kind of energy and interplay that you two have as a duo as well. How did you two link up?
We met because I went to String Summit and I met a friend there who now goes by the name Ivy. And Ivy connected Ben and I, said, "Hey, Joe, you've got to meet my friend Ben," because they were old friends from college. She heard my music and said, "Hey, I got this fiddler buddy up in Seattle. I think you'd really like what he does. And given, like, I've heard what you do." And so I met Ben up in Seattle briefly when I was visiting Ivy. And then he came down and started, and I had his band, the Gentleman Buck Hunters, opened for Renegade String Band in Portland. And then Gentleman Buck Hunters eventually was no more, and he joined Renegade String Band as our fiddler, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
And then so you two have a duo then in your own right as well, Benjo.
Yeah, we were just actually over in DC this past weekend, in our duo format, teaching some kids about Juneteenth and doing a celebratory Juneteenth concert with our former booking agent, Martha Danzik of Quicksilver Productions.
Oh, Howard had a wife, and she nagged him all his life. So he used it with your knife, like I said, he had a wife. Oh, Howard's dead and gone. Oh, Howard's dead and gone. Oh, Howard's dead and gone. Lord, no, Lord, left me here to sing this song.
So I really want to get into all of your awesome projects, but I wanted to actually step back in time a bit first and kind of start at the beginning. You know, you live in Seattle now, but you grew up pretty rural, as far as I understand. Could you talk a little bit about kind of the context you grew up in and maybe how that informed the path you started on as a musician?
Absolutely. My parents were back to the landers. You know, they built domes in the woods in rural Columbia County. My mom built her dome in Vernonia. My dad built his dome up at a place called Mist. And these are points on the map between Astoria and Portland and the northwest corner of Oregon in about 1983. I came along, I was born in 1984. And in 1986, a couple of their friends recorded an album called Dog Salmon and Rutabagas. And Dog Salmon and Rutabagas is the brainchild of Hobie Kiter and David Berge. And Hobie wrote almost all the songs on that record. He recorded a couple of Timberbound songs. They recorded one of Dave's songs. And this was, to me, some of the most authentic Northwest folk music ever recorded. And I call it authentic because it is music that doesn't shy away from the pain and sadness of being a white person living in a part of America where the indigenous presence has been made all too invisible, right? You can go to other parts of, if you go down to New Mexico, for instance, you still see the imprint of indigenous culture, I think, on the on a lot of the forms and parts of the world there. And I feel like where I was raised, I knew that indigenous people had been there, but I wasn't even conscious that Chinook folks were still around, you know. So Hobie Keiter's songs talk about where did all the timber go. They talk about the forest fires. They talk, you know, they make glancing references to indigenous people. You know, like the last verse of Hobie's epic song about the Tillamook burn is, you know, my old Indian George told me, and I guess his ghost would scold me if I didn't pass this message to you. Those greedy white strangers brought the Thunderbird's anger down on the many and the few, you know. And so he's talking about, you know, maybe with an imperfect term, right? We don't call folks Indians. That's not what they are. But to the best of his ability, Hobie wrote songs that acknowledged, like, hey, people that look like me were not here first, and there are people that know how to steward this land. And you know, so the reality of this existence here is more clear in those songs. And so that was really a big like, you know, obviously unconsciously at first made a big impression on me. And the songs talk about the trees and the different trees that grow here, and dog, salmon, and rutabagas, right? Is like, you better like dog, salmon, and rutabagas, boiled spuds, green tomatoes, venison's a standard bill of fare. And if you can't live on that, you have to live on air, right? Hobie's poetry and lyrics captured the Northwest in a very beautiful and real way. And so that had the deepest influence on me musically. And I only came over time to, you know, because, you know, it's your parents' friends, it's your parents' music. All kids are like, ah, my parents, yeah, that's, you know. So I had to get over that. But by the time I was 16 or 17, I was understanding just how much I loved and respected that music. And so that was a huge influence.
I worked in cedar mill all my life. Ain't got nothing but an old shake knife. It's a hard time. It's cedar mill boys, hard times everywhere. Got all my fingers set for three, four, five teeth, and the rest is me. It's a hard time. Cedar mill boys, hard times everywhere. Hard times, cedar mill boys, hard times. Cedar mill boys, hard times. Cedar mill boys, hard times everywhere.
There's a couple threads I want to pull out a little more there. You were talking a lot about those early musicians that your folks knew and that influenced some of your later projects. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that Timberbound project, which I absolutely love, by the way. On one hand, it's just great, you know, folk music and that you can listen to and appreciate on that level. But, you know, so much of our, like, I guess you would call it our folk catalog comes from the American South. And it's great music, but, you know, a lot of that stuff doesn't really speak to our experience as much. And the Timberbound right. project of yours really does. And so talk a little bit more about, yeah, just how you got into the project and where folks can, you know, find that Timberbound project.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, I appreciate the prod because, yeah, you know, I emphasized really strongly Hobie Keiter and Dave Berge because they were the path through which I discovered those songs. You know, they were part of an obscure band called Timberbound that was just a band for a couple of years, like 1976 and 77. That band was in existence. And so the story there goes that there was this plot of land. It's called Kesey. Out at the end of the train line, the Oregon American Logging Company left behind some loggers' cabins out there. And I believe it was John Ullman who tipped off his friends John Cunick and Kim Cunick, who met up in Seattle around kind of the hippie scene of UW in the late 60s. And they were asked, like, hey, do you want to go steward this plot of land down in Oregon? And they said, yeah. And so they had just kind of started playing folk music together, and they moved down to the Kesey property. They moved into one of these old logger cabins, no running water, no electricity. And so they wrote songs together out there at Kesey. And John worked part-time in a sawmill for his friend Russ Elson, and Kim worked part-time in Sam's food store down in Vernonia. Vernonia's maybe, I don't know, a 20-minute drive down the hill. It's like the bigger logging camp that turned into a town. And so John and Kim's songs were beautiful, really, like Hobie's songs, captured something essential and beautiful about being one of the descendants of the colonizers here in the Pacific Northwest, and what that experience is like, what the land feels like, you know, the humor and the joy and the sadness and the beauty of this life. And so they wrote these songs, and then tragically John died in a car accident in early 1976. And so he and Kim had already talked about creating a songbook, and so she, as a way to commemorate her life with John and their work together, she worked the whole year after he passed, she put together this songbook. And so her friends Hobie Kiter and Dave Berge and Mark Loring would come out most weekends and kind of prop her up, play music with her, socialize with her, and of course they were all in love with her. And so John Ullman, the guy who had got John and Kim down to Kesey, heard them playing, and he by this time had started the Seattle Folklore Society and was booking everybody from Doc Watson to Reverend Gary Davis to Lightnin' Hopkins, Mississippi John Hurt. They were bringing all of these, you know, the giants that still walked the earth, they were bringing them out to the Northwest and taking them on tour. When they brought Mike Seeger out, he said, hey, you all are sounding pretty good, because he heard Timberbound practicing out there at Kesey. And so he had them open up for Mike Seeger. And that was kind of like the height of their fame as a obscure Northwest folk band, and they named their band after the title song in the songbook, Timberbound. So they would play John and Kim songs, they would play some of Hobie's originals, and they would play some gospel tunes. So that is the long and involved story of John and Kim Cunick and the creation of the Timberbound songs. And if you go to our SoundCloud page, is the best place to hear that music. We even managed to get Dave Berge before he passed. He plays auto harp on one of his songs about logging called The Timber Faller. That you can hear there on the Timber, you know, I think it's soundcloud.com/timberbound. And so that, you know, I revived the name and the music because, you know, Hobie and Dave played those songs when I was a kid. I would hear a few of them. One of them is on their album that I referenced before. Most of those songs had never been recorded in a recording studio, the exception of Timberbound and Old Hollow School. It was mostly just they lived in the songbook and they lived in our community. And so I know with some of my college buddies, an old family friend, and a classical violinist, Ginny Estrin, we made that record in 2016 to kind of put these songs out there so that people could also hear them, in addition for those that weren't able to play them out of a songbook. So that's the Timberbound Project.
You are deeply involved in Seattle's Rhapsody Project. Maybe just give a little overview of what the Rhapsody Project does, and then we can, you know, talk about your involvement with it.
Happily, yeah. So the Rhapsody Project, you know, it's another thing that started with Ben and I, just being like, man, this music education that we were given was pretty whack. Like, they left out a lot. And a lot of the way in which we are taught in schools is very European in nature. Not that there's everything wrong with that, but there are some things wrong with that.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Right?
Yeah. It's so, like, here's how to teach a kid how to play music. Is like, here, play an instrument you've never seen before and a song that is like high-level classical music. That'll get you to love playing music, right?
Yeah, just look at these dots on this page, and you know, and think about all the fun you're gonna have. And I mean, I you know, Ben was raised classically, so he can sight read. You know, I can read music, but I'm a piss poor sight reader, and I think that it's a beautiful and wonderful skill, and I wish I had it. But you know, in American culture, the way our music was created and passed down is through social settings, right? It's through osmosis. It's through, you're the little kid playing along the wall at the corn shucking while the string band has its way with some old fiddle tune, and people are doing communal work together, right? That that's more of the setting in which music is transmitted traditionally in America. And so Ben and I were going, can we get our students playing music in a social setting as opposed to a formal one? Can we get music, can we emphasize to them that music can be a way to hang out, a way to relax, a way to just be in community with one another and not put it so much on play this note on this beat, blah, blah, blah. It's like, this is how the song goes, join in. So it started with Ben and I, and with a lot of support from Beth Fortune and also Kelly Klingenbar, who is now at Seattle Jazz Ed. And so we would just try to get these kids playing this music, and we're just going to relax, play music, have fun, be goofy with it, you know? But again, we started this thing in 2013. So geez, I mean, that's almost 10 years ago now. And it's spiraled, it's developed immensely since then. So now the Rhapsody Project is defined as a community that celebrates music and heritage through an anti-racist lens. And that means that we try to inform people about all the lessons that the music contains for combating racism and discrimination in our communities and establishing cultural equity in our culture. And so the pandemic gave me space to do a thing that I had been wanting to do, which is kind of bottle up somehow the lessons I took from touring with Ben, with Dom Flemons, with Phil Wiggins, with my wife Briar, touring with these very talented and notable Black American musicians, and being the white guy in the room sometimes, or in rooms full of Black folks, and being like, oh, like there's a lot of lessons for white people in the music and in the culture that we're not tapping into. And so I created a program for Rhapsody called Face the Music, which is like an 8-week course that people can take online and learn, like they basically use the stories of all too obscure Black American musicians and songs as a jumping off point to talk about issues of race, equity, and, you know, how to confront racism in your own spheres of influence. I could talk on and on about the Rhapsody Project. Yeah. The other thing is that we take kids to that blues festival I was talking about earlier, Port Townsend Acoustic Blues Festival. We bring our students up there every summer that it's in person, and you know, connect them with culture bearers from around the country. So that is some of the work of the Rhapsody Project. You can learn all about it on the rhapsodyproject.org, and it's probably linked. It's definitely linked in my website, you know, joebanjo.net. But if you want to get involved, if you want to take one of those programs, if you have a way to contribute, I would love you to get in touch. I would just love to hear from you because, you know, it's a community and we need everybody to support it because it's really meaningful work, but it's very challenging work. And our society is not set up to pay for it, as it turns out.
Yeah. Yeah. It must be really meaningful to work with youth and like help them develop a love of folk and blues music and keep them connected to kind of that tradition like that.
Yeah, it's really exciting. And I mean, you know, what we do is we emphasize to the students, like you are composed of layers of heritage. You are not just your ethnicity. You are not just your gender identity. You are not only the music that you play right now, right? You are composed of all these different layers. And so let's connect with multiple layers and get you involved in expressing those things in your music.
Super interested in the Maxville Heritage Interpretive Center, and that's based out in Joseph, Oregon, correct?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I think a lot of folks don't know the history of that, and it is a fascinating one.
By all means. So, through Facebook, I learned about Gwen Trice, and she, in about 2010, started a museum to tell the story of a logging camp that existed in Wallowa County, Oregon. This is Northeast Oregon now, the other side of the state. And her father was one of the Black loggers who came up and logged this plot of land outside of Enterprise and Joseph, Oregon, back in the 20s. If you were black at that time in Oregon, you were legally, you were supposed to be lashed 37 times every 6 months until you moved away. That was the law created to, you know, make Oregon into a white paradise. So, but in spite of that, there were these multi-ethnic logging camps. The town Vernonia I mentioned earlier was another one. You know, Gwen eventually showed me a plot that shows like that there were Japanese, Filipino, and black loggers out at the Vernonia camp near where I grew up. A fact that was always invisible to me. Never did anybody indicate anything of that sort in my childhood. So she's doing really vital work saying, hey, I'm black, I'm here, I grew up here. And my father was part of this work that was done here that we identify with Oregon. But when we think of a lumberjack, we do not picture a black person. We do not picture a brown person. We picture a white guy like a Paul Bunyan type. And so in combating that erasure and in highlighting this incredible story of a segregated multi-ethnic logging camp in rural Oregon, Gwen founded the Maxville Heritage Interpretive Center. And so she's celebrating timber culture and the history, the true history of Oregon. I mean, it's just an incredible story. So yeah. Gwen is telling that story, and I'm doing what I can to support that work as, you know, part of the necessary allyship that I think most people that look like me in Oregon want to take part in. But it's when you grow up like I did, it's hard to know how. So she's one of the people that's helped me learn how.
And that, again, is Gwen Trice with the Maxville Heritage Interpretive Center. She's doing great work. And, yeah, I'm excited that you're a part of that. And people can learn more about that work at maxvilleheritage.org. And they have a great website with a lot of really good information and ways to learn more about that history that a lot of people have willfully tried to suppress and have us, you know, our collective memories forget. So I appreciate her and you keeping that alive and all the other folks obviously involved in that project.
They come to the coast because you love the rain and the giant old growth trees. There wasn't much work way back in the brush for a flatland man, you see. He come from the Rockies to Oregon because he loved the tree. He thought he was young and strong enough to do whatever he pleased.
You know, you grew up in rural Oregon. You know, a lot of your musical tradition that you've gravitated towards is, you know, rural folk music and rural blues music. And mm-hmm. yet you're, you know, in the definitely the yeah. largest city in the Northwest. And because I think that that's part of what a person has to do to make it as a musician, and not to take anything away from Seattle as a beautiful city. But, you know, I live in rural Oregon, and I love living in rural Oregon, but, you know, the music scene and the music opportunities out here are so few and far between, and sure. I just wonder if you've ever thought about what it would take to sort of revitalize some of these local small-town music scenes or venues that can actually make it so that a person could go on a tour without having to drive 12 hours between gigs. You know what I mean?
Right. I think it has to be a long-term strategy, and it has to be rooted in like education of, you know, our young people don't get exposed to enough live music. Even when they are, they don't really know how to engage with it, right? Like I think of my friend Eric Sangren, who's an old family friend. He's a painter, my folks' age. And he talked about in teaching his students at community college in Aberdeen, Washington, realizing that like his students don't know how to look at things, don't know how to look at a painting or a drawing in the same way that he knows how to. They simply don't have the visual language. And so that's what we're up against, in that we're raising generations of people who experience music through a metal box functionally, right? So we have to create settings in which people recognize the power and vitality of live music, and that it just does a thing to you and your community that no, what, you know, it can be Stevie Wonder quality, no recorded music can do, right? live music does something different. To me, we have to create scenes, we have to create cultures, we have to create venues where it's a three-pronged stool at the least. There is music, yes, but there is equally dancing, and the music and the dance are informing and like, you know, creating that circuit of energy that we all love. And then there is incredible food, you know, like if you say go to Louisiana and you experience some Creole or Cajun culture where there's gumbo and there's automatically dancing and there's automatically live music, and no thing is more important than the other, right? They all are codependent. I think that's what we need. And when we have venues like that, then we're going to have that ecosystem of venues that you're talking about to make it workable. But we have to figure out how to get back to that. And it ain't a short-term proposition.
No, I agree. For folks out there who do have, you know, if somebody in your community has house concerts, if there is a local venue that has made it through the pandemic or is maybe hoping to open back up, it's really important to support those venues, even if you don't like every act that comes through. Like,
yep,
like you're saying, Joe, it's a, you know, it's in your long-term interest, it's in our long-term interest out here in rural areas to, you know, be putting extra support into these things.
Right.
Well, Joe, I have appreciated talking to you so much today, and I really hope that we get to pick together again before, you know, another like 5-6 years has passed.
Likewise, Michael. I'd love that.
Okay, well, your website, Joe, is joebanjo.net. That's J-O-E-B-A.
Andy Whoa Whoa looks a scream. Have him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy Whoa Whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO.